With her short, tousled bobbed hair, she reminded me of one of those celebrated female aviators in the old newsreels, but without the sense of doom that overhung so many of them. She waved, and the camera moved away to focus upon two little girls who waved madly back, holding their hands up as if to shield their eyes from the sun. Feely and Daffy, aged about 7 and 2 respectively. As Harriet lowered herself carefully down from the wing, I saw, for the first time, her protruding belly. Although the bump was partially hidden by her flying gear, it was easy enough to see that she was pregnant. That bump in her bloomers was me. How peculiar it was to be present in the scene, and yet not present, like the assistant in a conjuring show. What was I feeling? Embarrassment? Pride? Happiness? It was none of these things. It was a bittersweet fact that while Feely and Daffy were sharing that long-ago sunshine with Harriet, I was not. Now a close-up of Father approaching as if ambling out from the house. He glances up shyly and fiddles with something in his jacket pocket, then smiles at the camera. This scene was apparently filmed by Harriet. A quick change of scene, and as in the background, Feely and Daffy dabble like ducks at the edge of the ornamental lake. Father and Harriet, filmed by someone else, picnic on a blanket in front of the folly. This was the scene I had examined in the laboratory. She smiles at him, and he at her. He turns away to remove something from a wicker hamper, and in that instant, she becomes dead serious, turns to the camera, and mouths a couple of words, miming them in an exaggerated manner, as if giving instructions to someone through a window pane. I was caught off guard. What had Harriet said? Normally, I'm a first-rate lip reader. It is a skill I taught myself, first by sitting at the breakfast and dinner tables with my fingers stuffed into my ears, and later using the same technique at the cinema. I had sat at Bishop's Lacey's single bus stop with wads of cotton in both ears. Dr. Darby says it's a very bad infection, Mrs. Belfield. Eavesdropping on early morning shoppers as they headed for the market in Malden Fenwick. Unless I was greatly mistaken, the words on Harriet's lips had been pheasant sandwiches. Pheasant sandwiches? I stopped the projector, pushed the reverse lever, and backed the film up, then viewed the scene again. The folly in the blanket, Harriet and Father. She speaks the words again. Pheasant sandwiches. She articulates the words so clearly I can almost hear the sound of her voice. But to whom had she been speaking? Since she and Father were clearly in front of the camera, who had been behind it? What unseen third party had been present at that long-ago picnic? My options of finding out seemed limited. Feely and Daffy, at least Daffy for certain, had been too young to remember. And I could hardly ask Father without admitting to finding and developing the forgotten film. I was on my own, as usual. Feely, I said, stopping her dead in the middle of the Andante Cantabile from Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 8, the Pathétique. Any interruption when she was playing made Feely furious, which gave me the upper hand automatically, as long as I remained perfectly calm, cool, and collected. What? She demanded, jumping to her feet and slamming down the lid on the keyboard, which made a lovely sound. A kind of harmonic mooing that went on echoing through the piano strings for a surprisingly long time, like the Aeolian harps whose strings, Daffy had told me, were played by the wind. Nothing, I said, forming my face into its slightly hurt but bearing up in spite of it look. It's just that I thought you might like a cup of tea. All right, Feely demanded. What are you up to? She knew me as well as the magic mirror knew the wicked queen. "I'm not up to anything," I replied. "I was merely making an effort to be nice." I had her off balance. I could see it in her eyes. "Yes, all right then," she said suddenly, seizing the opportunity. "I think I should rather fancy a cup of tea." Ha! She thought she'd won, and the game had barely even begun. "Her Majesty is demanding a cup of tea," I told Mrs. Mallet. "If you'll be so good as to make one, I'll take it in to her myself."
"Of course," said Mrs. Mallet. "You shall have it in 2 shakes of a dead lamb's tail."
Mrs. M. always said, "in 2 shakes of a dead lamb's tail," when she was peeved, but didn't want to show it. "A dead lamb's tail is a way of saucing 'em off, without getting yourself into hot water. It means, kiss my chump, without actually saying so," she had once confided, but had now obviously forgotten she'd told me. Feely was by this time back into the Beethoven sonata. I put the teacup silently on the table and sat down in a bolt upright, attentive position, with my knees together, my hands folded daintily in my lap, modelling my posture on Cynthia Richardson, the vicar's wife. I even pursed my lips a little prunishly. When Feely had finished, I let a respectful silence hang in the air while I counted to 11, partly because it was my age, although not for much longer, and partly because 11 seconds seemed to me a perfect balance between awe and insolence. "Feely, I was thinking," I said.
"How novel," she interrupted.
"I hope nothing was damaged." I ignored her. "Have you ever thought of playing for the cinema, like Brief Encounter or the Warsaw Concerto in Dangerous Moonlight?" "Perhaps," she said rather dreamily, forgetting her recent sarcasm. "Perhaps one day I shall be asked." Feely's only professional film performance had been as a pair of disembodied hands in a never-to-be-completed Phyllis Wyvern film, of which only a few scenes had been shot at Buckshaw before its star came to what I believe is called rather a sticky end. I knew how disappointed Feely had been. "I remember how beautiful your hands were in the film. It was remarkable, considering that you'd never before so much as seen a cine camera." I waited for her to contradict me, but she didn't. "Some people are fortunate enough to have had cine films taken of them when they were children. They say that it builds much greater confidence for later on. Eileen Joyce said so on the BBC." This was a brazen lie. Eileen Joyce had said no such thing. But I knew that since she was Feely's musical idol, the mere mention of the famous pianist's name would add credibility to my twisting of the truth. "Too bad there were no cine films taken of you when you were a child," I said. "It might have given you a leg up." Feely, lost in thought, gazed out the drawing-room window and across the ornamental lake. Was she thinking of that long-ago day when she was 7? I couldn't leave it to chance.
"Odd, isn't it," I prompted, "that Harriet didn't own a cine camera? I should have thought that someone like her would have."
"Oh, but she did," Feely exclaimed, "before you were born. But when you came along, she put it away, for obvious reasons." Ordinarily, I'd have made some rude comeback, but necessity, as someone once remarked, or should have remarked, is the mother of keeping your lip zipped.
"Obvious reasons?" I asked. I was willing to suffer any indignity to keep this conversation alive.
"She didn't want to risk breaking it."
I laughed too loudly, hating myself.
"I'll bet she wasted lots of film on you, though," I said.
"Miles of it," Feely said. "Simply miles and miles and miles."
"Where is it, then? I've never seen it."
Feely shrugged.
"Who knows? Why are you so suddenly interested?"
"Curiosity," I said. "I believe you, though. It sounds so like Harriet to have wasted all that film on others. I wonder if anyone ever thought to take any films of her.
I could hardly put it any more plainly than that.
Not that I remember, Feely said, and gave herself back to Beethoven.
I stood behind her, peering over her shoulder at the music, an invasion of her personal boundaries which I know perfectly well gives her the creeps. Nevertheless, she ignored me and kept on playing.
What does tempo rubato mean? I asked, pointing at her penciled words in the margin.
Stolen time, Feely said without missing a note.
Stolen time. Her words hit me in the stomach like a sledgehammer. Wasn't that what I was doing by developing a film that was taken before I was born? Stealing time from the past of others and trying to make it my own? For some stupid reason, my eyes were suddenly full of warm water, dangerously close to brimming over. I stood for a while behind my sister, letting the pathetique wash over me. After a time, I reached out and put my hand on her shoulder. We both of us pretended it wasn't happening, but both of us knew that it was, because Harriet was coming home.
Chapter 5.
Now, still cradled in the comforting upholstery of the Rolls-Royce, I roused myself from my memories. We had not yet reached Buckshaw. Outside the car's windows, the narrow lane was lined on both sides with spectators who had strung themselves out along the weedy verge to watch Harriet's homecoming. So many of the dear village faces, I thought, starched into stiffness by the death of one of their own. It was a scene most of them would remember for the rest of their lives. Tully Stoker, his daughter Mary, and Ned Cropper, the potboy of the 13 Drakes, all of whom had been perched on a stile as we approached, jumped smartly to the ground and moved closer. Tully removed his cap, his eyes following the hearse. Ned craned his neck, trying to get a look at Feely in the back seat of the Rolls, where she rode behind me in silence, with Father, Daffy, and Aunt Felicity. I was sitting beside Dogger, who was at the wheel, and I could see Feely's face clearly in the mirror. She was staring straight ahead. No one spoke. Now we were creeping past the Mrs. Puddock, Lavinia and Aurelia, the joint proprietresses of the St. Nicholas Tea Room in Bishop's Lacey. Both of them were dressed in a kind of ancient bombazine, which had once been black, but was now a shade of curdled brown. Both clutched matching Victorian evening bags, which were weirdly out of place in a country lane. I couldn't help wondering what was inside them. Miss Aurelia gave us a cheery wave as we hove alongside, but her sister seized her hand and shoved it down roughly. Dieter stood a little way back from the verge, almost in the ditch, with his employer, Gordon Ingleby of Culverhouse Farm. Although Father had invited Dieter to join us on this sad occasion, he had politely declined. As a former German prisoner of war, his presence might be resented, he had said, and even though he wanted desperately to be at Feely's side, he felt it best to keep a respectful distance, at least for now. There had been a row about this at Buckshaw, with much slamming of doors, raising of voices, reddening of faces, and, on the part of a certain person not to be named, tears, followed by the brutal kicking of a wastebasket and a flinging of oneself face down upon one's bed. Now, as we drove slowly past, Feely didn't give Dieter so much as a glance through the glass. Ahead of us in the narrow lane, Harriet's hearse glinted unnervingly in the dappled sunlight, seeming to shift out of this world and into another and back again as its polished paint reflected darkened versions of the moving fields, the trees overhead, the hedgerows, and the sky. The sky. Heaven. Heaven was where Harriet was, at least according to Denwin Richardson, the vicar.
I think that I am quite correct in assuring you, Flavia,
that she is sipping tea with her ancestors, even as we speak, he had told me. I knew he was doing his best to comfort me, but a part of me knew all too well, and from personal experience, that Harriet's ancestors, and mine, come to think of it, were mouldering away in crumbling coffins in the crypt of St. Tancred's, and quite unlikely to be sipping tea or anything else, unless it was the seepage from the church's rotting rain spouts. He was a dear man, the vicar, but dreadfully naive, and I sometimes thought that there were certain aspects of life and death which eluded him completely. Chemistry teaches us all that can be known about corruption, and I realized with a shock that I had learned more at the altar of the Bunsen burner than at all the altars of the competition combined. Except about the soul, of course. The only vessel in which the soul could be studied was a living human body, which made it as difficult as trying to study the soul of a Mexican jumping bean. We could learn nothing about the soul from a corpse, I had decided, after several first-hand encounters with cadavers. Which brought me back to the man under the wheels of the train. Who was he? What was he doing on the platform at Buckshaw Holt? Had he come down from London on Harriet's funeral train with the other dignitaries? Presumably he had, since I hadn't seen him there before the train pulled into the station. What had he meant about the Nide being under? And who on earth was the gamekeeper? I didn't dare ask. It was neither the time nor the place. The stony silence inside the rolls told me that each of us remained lost in our own thoughts. To each of the mourners outside in the lane, I would be no more than a pale face glimpsed for a moment behind the glass. I wished I could smile at each of them, but I knew I must not, since a grinning mug would spoil their memories of this sad occasion. We were all of us mourners, overtaken by the moment. It was not ours to shape. We must give ourselves over to being the grieving family, upon whom others must be permitted to shower sympathy. All of this I knew without ever having been told. It had somehow been born in my blood. Perhaps this was what Aunt Felicity had meant when she had told me that day upon the island in the ornamental lake that it had been left to me to carry the torch, to carry on the glorious name de Luz. Wherever it may lead you, she had added. Her words still rang in my head. You must never be deflected by unpleasantness. I want you to remember that. Although it may not be apparent to others, your duty will become as clear to you as if it were a white line painted down the middle of the road. You must follow it, Flavia.
Even when it leads to murder? I had asked.
Even when it leads to murder. Could it be that the slightly dotty old woman sitting in rigid silence behind me in the rolls had actually spoken those words? I knew that I needed now, more than ever, to get her alone. But first there was the arrival at Buckshaw to be got through. It was the part of the day I had been dreading more than anything. We had been briefed on the scheduled events. At 10 a.m., Harriet's coffin would arrive at Buckshaw Holt, which it had now done. It would be transported by hearse to the front door of Buckshaw, from which point it would be carried inside and placed on trestles in Harriet's boudoir, which was upstairs at the extreme south end of the west wing. This seemed at first a peculiar choice of rooms for a lying in state. The enormous foyer, with its dark wood panelling, black and white checkered floor tiles, and double rising staircases, would have provided a much grander setting than Harriet's private apartments, which Father had preserved as a shrine to her memory. Except for the looking glass on the dresser and the cheval glass in the corner, each of which had been covered just yesterday with a black pall, everything in the boudoir, from Harriet's Fabergé combs and brushes, one of which still had several strands of her hair caught up in its bristles, and the leek-scent bottles, to her absurdly practical carpet slippers, standing ready beside her great Princess and the Pea four-poster bed, was precisely as she had left it on that last day.
Only afterwards had it occurred to me not only that Father wanted Harriet to be returned to her private sanctuary, but that the room where she was to lie in state was connected to his own by a private door. Now Dogger was turning the car in at the Mulford gates, whose mossy stone griffins stared down impassively upon the procession. I thought, just for a moment as we swept past, that the drops of green water, which still oozed from the smutty corners of their eyes after last night's rain, were actually tears. Out of respect, the for sale sign had been uprooted and put discreetly out of sight until after the funeral. Up the long avenue we went, under the canopy of chestnuts. "Arrive, Buckshaw, 10:30 hours," it had said on the schedule Father posted in the drawing room. And it was so. Even as we stepped from the rolls, the clock in the tower of St. Tancred's, a mile to the north across the fields, struck the half hour. Dogger opened the car's doors for us, one at a time, and we formed a respectful double line on both sides of the front entrance. There we stood, looking everywhere but straight ahead, as Harriet's coffin was hauled on chromium rollers from the hearse by six black-suited bearers, all of them strangers, and carried into the house. I had never seen Father look more haggard. A wayward bit of breeze ruffled the front of his hair, causing it to stand on end, like a man frightened out of his wits. I wanted to fly to his side and comb it down with my fingers. But of course I didn't. I fell in behind the coffin, as I thought was only right. As youngest of the family, I would be a sort of flower girl, first in the procession. But Father stopped me with a hand on my shoulder. Although his sad blue eyes looked directly into mine, he said not a word. And yet I understood, as if he had handed me a fat procedures manual. I knew that we were meant to linger a bit longer out of doors. Father didn't want us to see Harriet's coffin being manhandled up the stairs. It's things like this that really shake me. Sudden, terrifying glimpses into the world of being an adult. And they are sometimes things that I am not sure I really want to know. There we stood, like stone chessmen. Father, the checkmated king, graceful but fatally wounded in defeat. Aunt Felicity, the ancient queen, her black hat askew, humming some tuneless tune to herself. Feely and Daffy, the rooks, the two remote towers at the distant corners of our castle world. And me, Flavia Deluce, pawn. Well, not quite, actually, although that was how I felt at the time. Since Harriet's body had been found in a Himalayan glacier, our lives at Buckshaw seemed to have fallen under the control of some unseen force. We were told the when, the where, and the how of everything, but never the why. Somewhere, in some far-off vastness, arrangements were being made, plans being laid, all of which seemed to trickle down to us as if they were the freshly melted decrees of some unknown ice god. "Do this, do that, be here, be there," they commanded, and we obeyed. Blindly, it seemed. That was what I was thinking when my acute hearing picked up a clattering noise coming from the direction of the gates. I turned just in time to see a most unusual vehicle appearing from among the chestnuts and the hedges and coming to a halt on the gravel forecourt. The thing was mint green and boxy, like the caged lift from a Welsh coal mine. It had an open frame upon which a canvas roof could be strapped in case of rain, and a winch mounted on its nose. I recognized it at once as a Land Rover. We had seen a similar model not all that long ago in a safari film at the cinema. Seated at the wheel was a middle-aged woman in a black short-sleeved dress. She braked and yanked the Liberty scarf off her head as if it was a starting cord for an outboard motor, letting her long red hair tumble to her shoulders in the process. She stepped down from the Land Rover as if she owned the world, and looked about at her surroundings with what was either partial amusement or total contempt. "Undine, come," she said, extending a hand in the manner of God on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. There was an alarming flutter in the depths of the Land Rover, and a most peculiar child shot up her head. She bore no resemblance to the woman, whom I took to be her mother. She had a pasty moon face, pale blue eyes, black-rimmed spectacles of the national health variety, and the haunting, ageless look of one of those bruised-looking baby birds that has fallen helpless and unfinished from the nest. Some primal fear stirred inside of me. They crunched across the gravel and stopped in front of Father.
"Lena," Father said.
"Sorry we're late," the woman answered. "The Cornish roads were, well, you know what Cornish roads can be, and the ones in, good heavens, could this be little Flavia?"
I said nothing. If the answer was yes, she wasn't going to hear it from me.
"She's awfully like her mother, isn't she?" the supposed Lena asked, still talking to Father and not looking at me at all, as if I wasn't there.
"And you are?" I asked, just as I had asked the stranger at the station. It may have been rude, but on such an occasion as today, one was entitled to a certain brittleness.
"Your cousins, dear, Lena and Undine, of the Cornwall Deluces. Surely you've heard of us?"
"I'm afraid not," I said. And all the while, Feely and Daffy were standing open-mouthed. Aunt Felicity had already turned abruptly away and vanished into the black maw of the open door.
"Shall we go inside?" Lena said, and it was not a question.
"Come along, Undine. It's chilly here. We're likely to catch our deaths of cold."
It was chilly all right, but not the way she meant. How could you be chilly on such an unseasonably sunny day?
Undine stuck out her tongue as she marched past me and into the house. In the foyer, Father spoke quietly to Dogger, who went quickly about removing the intruder's luggage from the Land Rover and hauling it to an upstairs room. With that seen to, Father turned and began to trudge heavily up the stairs himself, as if his shoes were filled with lead.
Bong! A sudden deafening explosion of noise filled the foyer. Father stopped in his tracks, and I spun round. Undine was hacking away at the Chinese dinner gong with Father's prized Malacca walking stick, which she had pulled from the umbrella stand inside the front door. Bong, 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 bong. The mother seemed oblivious. Cousin Lena, if indeed that's who the woman was, stood staring appreciatively, with her head thrown back, at the panelling and the paintings, as if she were the prodigal daughter being welcomed home, peeling off her black gloves almost obscenely as she mentally totted up the value of the artwork. Now the child was running up and down the staircase, upon which Father had stopped in disbelief, clattering the cane along the uprights of the banister as if they were a picket fence.
Drrr, drrr, drrr.
Feely and Daffy were, for the first time in living memory, speechless. Feely was the first to make a move. She drifted off towards the drawing room. Daffy opened her mouth, then shut it, and made for the library at full speed.
"Flavia, dear," Lena said, "why don't you show Undine round the house? She's quite keen on paintings and so forth, aren't you, Undy?"
I felt what tasted like black vomit rising in my throat.
"Yes, Ibu,"
Undine said, slashing at the air with the cane as if she were cutting her way through the jungle. I kept my distance.
"Perhaps Miss Undine would like to view the sharks," Dogger suggested.
He had reappeared suddenly and silently on the staircase. There were no sharks at Buckshaw, I was quite sure of that, but part of me was hoping desperately that Dogger had rounded up a few. Perhaps he had secretly stocked the ornamental lake. Chapter 6. The great black shark came boiling up from the surface, hung motionless for a moment, its massive jaws gnashing at the air, then fell writhing back into the choppy waters. Undine shrieked.
again, she shouted. Again, again, again.
Very well, but this one must be the last, Dogger said, manipulating his bare hands in front of the shaded desk lamp, and the black shadow shark rose up once more on the wall, snapped fiendishly at the air, and splashed back into the billows of waving fingers. Dogger rolled down his sleeves, rebuttoned the cuffs, and switched off the lamp. He removed the blankets he had hung over the kitchen windows, and we blinked in the sudden light. When Dogger had gone, Undine said,
"Does he always make sharks?"
"No," I said. "I've seen him form elephants and crocodiles. His crocodile is quite terrifying, actually."
"Huh," Undine said. "I'm not scared of crocodiles."
I couldn't resist.
"I'll bet you've never seen one," I said. "Not in real life, anyway."
"I have too."
Little did she know that when it came to the bluffing game, she was up against a master. "I'll teach her a trick or two," I thought.
"Where precisely?" I asked. She probably didn't even know the meaning of the word precisely.
"In a mangrove swamp at Sembawang. It was a saltwater crocodile. They're the world's largest living reptile."
"Sembawang?" I must have sounded like the village idiot.
"Singapore," she said.
She pronounced it Singapore, with the accent on the last syllable.
"Have you never been to Singapore?"
Since I had not, I wondered how I could best quickly change the subject.
"Why do you call your mother Ibu?" I asked.
"It's Malay," she answered. "It means mother in Malay."
"Is Singapore in Malay?"
"No, Malay is a language, you silly goose. Singapore is a geographical location."
This discussion was not going at all as I had hoped. Time for another diversion.
"Undine," I said, "what a peculiar name."
Perhaps peculiar was a little harsh, but she had, after all, struck the first blow by calling me a silly goose.
"Not so peculiar as it might have been," she replied. "My father wanted to call me Sepia, but my mother prevailed."
That was the way she spoke. Prevailed. What a curious little creature she was. At one moment, she was a baby bawling for more amusement, and the next, she was talking like some boring old stick from the Explorers Club. Ageless, I thought. Yes, that was the word that best described Undine. Ageless. Still, I wasn't quite sure whether to believe her about the Singapore saltwater crocodile. I'd check her up later.
"I'm sorry about your mother," she said suddenly, out of the silence. "Ibu has spoken of her often."
"In Malay?" I asked, meaning to cut.
"In Malay and in English," she said. "In Singapore, we spoke both languages interchangeably."
"Interchangeably? Don't make me hurl my gastric acids."
"Have I caused you great distress?"
she asked.
"Distress?"
"Ibu said I was not to mention your mother's name at Buckshaw. She said it would cause great distress."
"Ibu speaks often of my mother, you say?"
I was still being more than a trifle snotty, but Undine didn't seem to notice.
"Yes, quite often," she said. "She cared for her a great deal."
I have to admit, I was touched.
"She wept," Undine said, "when they took your mother's body from the train."
Quite suddenly, my mind was reeling.
"From the train?" I asked, disbelieving her. "You weren't at the station."
"Yes, we were," Undine said. "Ibu said it was the least we could do. We were late. We parked off to one side, but we were still able to observe everything."
"I'm suddenly tired, Undine," I told her. "Find your own way upstairs. I'm going for a bit of a lie down." I stretched out on my bed, face down, unable to keep awake, unable to sleep, and guilt was the culprit. How could I have sat so calmly in the kitchen, watching a carefree shadow show, when all the while my mother was lying dead upstairs? Dead and lost, frozen in a glacier for a decade,
until some moronic mountaineer, posing for a snapshot, had stepped backwards into a crevasse, where a rescue party eventually found his, and her, icy remains.
How did I feel?
Guilty as sin. Why wasn't I blubbering and shrieking and ripping out my hair? Why wasn't I prowling the battlements of Buckshaw, howling into the wind? Even Cousin Lena had been able to weep at the station. Why, then, had I stood there on the platform like a piece of rotted timber, more attentive to the death of a stranger than to that of my own mother? Why had I needed to be reprimanded by a voice from the swamps of my mind? How could my grief have failed me so miserably? Perhaps Feely and Daffy had been right all along. Perhaps I really was a changeling. Perhaps Harriet really had plucked me from an orphanage, which would mean, of course, that I had no more real physical connection with her than does a monkey with the moon. Never in my life had I wanted more desperately to be a Deleuze, yet never had I felt less as if I actually were one. My family and I seemed to stand at opposite ends of the universe. I was as much a mystery to them as they were to me, and yet in spite of it, we needed one another. I rolled over, face up, and stared at the ceiling. The great loose bags of water-damaged paper that hung like mouldy barrage balloons above my head made me feel as if I were under attack from the very house itself. I covered my head with a pillow, but it was no use. In just a few hours, the people of the village would begin arriving at Buckshaw for Harriet's lying in state. Dogger would usher them in small groups up the west staircase to her boudoir, where they would stand gazing at their own reflections in the awful polish of that hideous coffin, whose contents were too horrible to be imagined. I leapt from my bed, and picking up the cine projector, carried it into my laboratory darkroom. Again, I threaded the film into the machine and switched it on. The picture was smaller, but brighter than it had been in my bedroom fireplace. And oddly enough, I was able to pick out more detail. Here is Harriet, scrambling once more from the cockpit of Blythe's spirit, with yours truly still invisible but present nevertheless beneath her flying togs. Feely and Daffy wave and shield their eyes. Was it from the sun, as I had supposed? Or had Harriet, in real life, been too radiant to look at? Whatever the case, by developing this forgotten film, I had, with the magic of chemistry, restored my mother to life. Deep inside me, something awoke, rolled over, and then went back to sleep. Now Father strolls towards the camera, unaware that he is trapped in another world, the world of the past. Daffy and Feely dabble at the edge of the ornamental lake, unaware that they are being filmed. The camera turns away, moving towards the blanket upon which Father and Harriet are picnicking. But wait, what was that shadow on the grass? I hadn't spotted it before. I stopped the projector and threw it into reverse. Yes, I was right. There was a dark blot on the grass. The shadow of the camera operator, whoever that may have been. I let the film run on a bit. As Father turns away to remove something from the hamper, Harriet turns to the camera and mouths those words again. Along with her, I speak them aloud, attempting to match my lips with hers, getting the feel of her words in my own mouth. Pheasant sandwiches, she says on the flickering image. Pheasant sandwiches, I say. Again, I back up the film for another glimpse of that fleeting shadow on the grass. To whom had Harriet mouthed those mysterious words? I watched it all again, wondering if there was a way to freeze the picture. Pheasant, Harriet said, and there was the most awful clatter and grinding. The projector had jammed. On the wall, the image had frozen mid-word.
Before my very eyes, Harriet's face began to turn brown, to darken, to shrivel, to bubble. The film had caught fire. A little column of dark, acrid smoke arose from somewhere inside the projector. If the film was cellulose nitrate, as I knew some films to be, I was in trouble. Even if it didn't explode, as was quite likely, the burning stuff could still fill the room almost instantly with a noxious mixture of hydrogen, carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, methane, and various unpleasant forms of the nitrogen oxides, to say nothing of cyanide. This little darkroom would, in an instant, become a perfect chamber of death. Buckshaw itself might then, in minutes, be reduced to ashes. I tore a laboratory apron from its hook on the wall and flung it over the machine. Cellulose nitrate doesn't require outside oxygen to burn. It contains its own. Nothing, not even fire extinguishers or water, can extinguish a cellulose nitrate blaze. Usually, when it comes to chemicals, I have my wits about me. But I must confess that in this case, I panicked. I dashed out of the darkroom, slammed the door behind me, and threw my back against it to keep it shut. A cloud of smoke escaped with me. I was standing like that, like a creature that had just dragged itself up out of the pit, when a voice from the smoke asked,
"Close call?"
It was Dogger. All I could do was nod.
"I beg your pardon for intruding," he said, fanning his hands at the air and opening a window. "But Colonel Deluce wishes the family to congregate in the drawing-room in a quarter of an hour."
"Thank you, Dogger. I shall be along directly."
Dogger didn't move. His nostrils dilated as he very slightly raised his chin. "Acetate?" he asked, not even bothering to take a full-fledged sniff.
"I believe it is," I said. "If it had been cellulose nitrate, we'd be in rather a sticky spot."
"Indeed," Dogger agreed. "May I be of assistance?"
I paused for only a fraction of a second before blurting out, "Can cinefilm be patched?"
"It can indeed," Dogger replied. "It is referred to in the trade, I believe, as splicing. A few drops of acetone should do the trick."
I reviewed the reaction in my mind. "Of course," I said. "A chemical bonding of the celluloid."
"Just so," Dogger said.
"I should have thought of that," I admitted. "Wherever did you learn it?"
A cloud drifted across Dogger's face, and for a few unsettling moments I felt as if I was suddenly in the presence of an entirely different person. A complete stranger.
"I don't know," he said at last, slowly. "These fragments appear suddenly sometimes at the tips of my fingers or on my tongue, as if..."
"Yes."
"As if..." I held my breath.
"Almost as if they were memories."
And with those words, the stranger had vanished. Dogger was suddenly back.
"May I be of assistance?" he asked again, as if nothing had happened. Now here was a pretty pickle. Much as I wanted Dogger's help, some dark and ancient part of me clung stubbornly to keeping the spool of film a secret.
It was all so beastly complicated. On the one hand, part of me wanted to be patted on the head and told, "Good girl, Flavia." While at the same time, another part wanted to hoard this new and unexpected glimpse of Harriet, to keep the film strictly to myself, like a dog with a fresh-flung soup bone. But then I thought, Dogger had never actually met Harriet in person. He had not come to Buckshaw until after the war. In an odd way, Harriet was no more to him than a shadow left behind by the deceased wife of his employer. In much the same way, I realized with an unpleasant pang, as she was to me. Except, of course, that she was also my mother. What it came down to, then, was this. How much did I trust Dogger? Could I swear him to secrecy? A minute later, we were in the dark room. Dogger had switched on the exhaust fan, which I hadn't known existed.
and was examining the sticky residue in the guts of the projector. The smoke and the fumes had dissipated, and with them the fear of an explosion.
"No great harm done, I think," he told me. "Not more than a few frames burnt. Do you have scissors?"
"No," I said. I had recently ruined a perfectly good pair of scissors by using them to cut a piece of zinc in a failed experiment intended to retrieve fingerprints from a downspout by an acid etching process of my own invention.
"Anything else, Sharp?" Dogger asked.
Somewhat shamefaced, I pulled from a drawer Father's prized Thiers Isard hollow ground straight razor, one I had borrowed in the past, which had come in so handy that I was thinking of asking for one of my own next Christmas.
"Ah," Dogger said, "so that's where it got to."
"I took care to keep it in its case," I pointed out, "accidents and so forth."
"Very wise," Dogger said.
He did not mention returning the thing to Father, as many people would have done. That's another of the things I love about Dogger. He's not a snitch.
"To begin with, we cut out the damaged section," Dogger explained, "then scrape the emulsion off the film at the two fresh ends."
"You sound as if you've done this before," I remarked casually, keeping a close eye on him.
"I have, Miss Flavia. Showing cine films of an instructional nature to hordes of uninterested men was once a not insubstantial part of my responsibility."
"Meaning?" I asked. Dogger's memory was always a puzzle. There were times when he could see his own past only, as St. Paul puts it, through a glass darkly, and yet at other times as if through a highly polished window. I have often thought how maddening it must be for him, like trying to view the moon with a telescope through tattered clouds on a windy night.
"Meaning," Dogger said, "that we shall have this film repaired obbledy-shuff. Ah, here we are, more satisfactory."
He held out a length of the repaired film for my inspection, flexing it and giving the new join a good hard snap. It seemed as good as new.
"You're a wizard, Dogger," I told him,
and he did not contradict me.
"Shall we give it a try?" he asked.
"Why not?" I said. My fears had vanished with the smoke. Having scraped the melted muck out of the projector, I suggested using Father's razor again, but Dogger wouldn't hear of it. We reloaded the film, switched off the lights, and watched closely as the flickering black and white images brought Harriet back to life. Here she was again, hauling herself once more from the cockpit of Bly's spirit. Father strolling self-consciously towards the camera.
"Hello," I said suddenly. "Who's that?"
"Your father," he said. "It's just that he's younger."
"No, behind him, in the window."
"I didn't see anyone," Dogger said. "Let's back things up."
He reversed the projector. He seemed more familiar with the controls than I had been.
"Just there. Look," I insisted, "in the window."
It happened so quickly, no wonder he had missed it. As Father approached the camera, there was a mere shifting of the light in an upstairs window, and then it was gone.
"A man, in shirt sleeves, tie and braces, papers in his hand."
"You've a sharper eye than I have, Miss Flavia," he said. "It was too quick for me. We shall have another look."
With infinitely patient fingers, he reversed the film again.
"Yes," he said, "I see him now. Quite distinct. Shirt sleeves, tie, braces, papers in his hand, hair parted in the middle."
"I think you're right," I said. "Let's take another squint."
Dogger smiled and ran the scene again. Was I seeing what I was seeing, or was my imagination playing up on me? But it wasn't the man in the film that interested me so much as his location.
"How odd," I said with a private shiver. "Whoever he is, he's in this very room." And it was true. Mr. Tie and Braces
it was quite easy to make him out clearly once you'd got used to it, had been shuffling papers at the window of my chemical laboratory, a room which had been abandoned and locked up in 1928 after Uncle Tarquin had been found by his housekeeper, stone-cold at his desk, gazing sightlessly through his microscope. Judging by the ages of Feely and Daffy, and by the fact that I had not yet made my appearance in the world, the film had been made in about 1939, not long before I was born, and about a year before Harriet's disappearance, more than 10 years after Uncle Tar's death. No one should have been in that room. So who was the man at the window? Had Father known he was there? Had Harriet? Surely they must have done. What do you make of it, Dogger? One of the things I love about myself is my ability to remain open to suggestion.
American, I should say. Military, by the shirt. An NCO, probably a corporal. Tall, 6'3", or perhaps 4. I must have gaped in awe. Elementary, as Sherlock Holmes might have said, Dogger explained. Only an American NCO would have the blade of his tie tucked into his shirt in such a way, between the second and third button, and his height can be judged easily against the top of that sash rail, which I judge to be 6 feet above the floor.
He pointed at the very window which had appeared in the film.
The question remains, he went on, as to what an American clerk was doing at Buckshaw in 1939.
My thoughts precisely, I said.
We best be getting along, Dogger said suddenly. They shall be awaiting us.
I'd completely forgotten about Father and Harriet. Chapter 7. I made an apologetic entrance to the drawing room. I needn't have bothered. No one paid me the slightest bit of attention. Father, as usual, was standing at the window, lost in his own thoughts. At the railway station, he had worn a suit of darkest blue with a black band on one arm, as if clinging desperately to the hope that even the slightest tinge of colour might bring Harriet home alive. But now he had given up and was dressed in black. His white face hanging above his mourning attire was awful. Feely and Daffy, too, wore black dresses I had never seen before. I shuddered at the thought of what ancient wardrobes must have been plundered to turn out something decent, something proper. Why hadn't Father dressed me in black? I wondered. Why had he let me be seen at Buckshaw Holt in a white summer dress, which, come to think of it, must have stuck out like a firework in the night sky? Like a fizzler at a funeral, I thought, but quickly forced it out of my mind. The problem with bereavement, I had already decided, was learning when to put on and when to take off the various masks that one was required to wear. With anyone who wasn't a Deleuze, profound and inconsolable grief, complete with limp hands and downcast eyes. With family, a distant coolness, which, to tell the truth, was not all that different from our everyday life. Only when one was alone in one's own room could one pull faces at oneself in one's looking-glass, hauling the corners of one's eyes down with first and fourth fingers spread, lolling one's tongue out and crossing one's eyes horribly, just to assure oneself that one was still alive. I can't believe I just wrote that, but it describes precisely how I felt. We might as well face it. Death is a bore,